I'm going to do something this morning that I can't say I've never done it, but I can't remember having done it. Something very different from what I usually do, and that is I'm going to read my sermon. In other words, it's all written out, unlike as usual. It's sort of written out in my head, and then I deliver it. But today, I feel like it's necessary to be absolutely crystal clear on what the issues are that we're going to be talking about today. And so it was important for me to be able to write them down and to write the ideas down and share them with you. There's a movement across the United States, and not just the United States, but also across Europe, especially in Hungary, Poland, Austria, Germany and France, even the Netherlands, even Greece. It is a movement that has as its watchword white supremacy. In each of these countries and others that I haven't mentioned, the call is to recreate society in ways that will expunge by mass murder or by law all non-Europeans or non-European Americans. Let me rephrase that. There is a movement across Europe and in the United States that people who are non-white should be cleansed from the lands in which they are living. They are trying to create a society that is for whites only. Now, interestingly, there are churches attached to these movements in all of the different countries in Europe, including in the United States. Churches that preach, teach, and confess that God has called one race of people to dominate the European and North American continents, along with Australia and New Zealand. They teach that Jesus was not a Jew. They teach that the Bible is not a Jewish book of scripture. It's actually a book by and for the race of non-Semitic whites. Now, showing that we don't really learn from history, it wasn't that long ago when, I think most people in this room, our parents offered up their lives to fight against this version of cruelty and sin. It wasn't that long ago when our parents offered up their lives to fight against cruelty and sin. I grew up on military bases. It was normal for me to be completely surrounded by military people. And one of the things that I learned growing up is that there is a possibility that an evil that is so great could take over our country and our world, and that people had to be ready to fight it all the time. I was taught that the great evil in this world at the time was called fascism or Nazism and then communism, but that this evil would engulf the entire world in flames and darkness. So it's a shock to me, knowing what I have two fathers that fought in World War II. One was wounded, and the other one was wounded psychologically. And now to see walking on the streets of my city, or on college campuses, or in Jewish neighborhoods, people marching and chanting and shouting against Jews, against blacks, against refugees, wearing the swastika armband, flying the swastika flag. Now, they're not the only ones. It wasn't just the swastika. Along with the swastika and the neo-Nazis came the, what I call the Confederate Restoration Movement. Confederate Restoration Movement claims there's no fundamental difference between George Washington and Thomas Jefferson and Stonewall Jackson and Robert E. Lee. All four of them had slaves. We know this. This is true. Does this mean that there's no difference between Washington and Jefferson and Jackson and Lee? Not at all. The first two, Washington, Jefferson, built a society of justice, even though they didn't fully understand what justice required because they held slaves. There's Washington and Jefferson, and then Jackson and Robert E. Lee. What they did was they committed high treason. They started a war against the United States. And it was a war that they made very clear what it was about. There's a lot of talk today, all over the internet and elsewhere, that the war between the states, the Civil War, was really about states' rights. And that each state had a right to determine important things in their own state without the federal government coming in and telling them what to do. The problem is, that's a lie. And it's easy to find out. All you have to do is look up the enabling legislation in each of the states that seceded from the Union. Each and every one of them said that the cause of their secession was slavery. It wasn't second, third, fourth. It was the first reason given that slavery and the expectation that Lincoln would force them to give up their slaves was the cause of the Civil War. Like the neo-Nazi movement, the Confederate Restoration Movement, they each have their own understanding of church. They each have their own, they have a kind of religion that goes along with their political beliefs. Among the neo-Nazis, it was this belief that God created one race of people that are supposed to dominate all other people. And that the race of people are chosen by God to destroy the vermin, is the word they use, to destroy the vermin of other races in the Confederate Restoration Movement. There's also religion, Christianity, that says that God punished Ham, one of the sons of Noah. And because God punished Ham, all of the descendants of Ham are cursed. Who are the descendants of Ham? Isn't it convenient that the descendants of Ham supposedly are African Americans? And so that they can make the claim, the Confederate Restoration Movement can make the claim that what God has done is created a people that are under a curse that lasts forever. And the curse is that they will become black and they will have to serve forever their white masters. When I was younger, I remember very clearly conversations among my family members. Blacks can't be quarterbacks because they're not smart enough. They can't be pitchers. I was very into sports. They can't be pitchers because they're not smart enough. They certainly can't be CEOs. They're not smart enough. It just automatically was assumed that if you were a black, you could not have certain roles in society because the primary role that God made for you was to be a servant of white masters. That is what your task was to be. And I, as late as seminary days, which was in the 70s, we were still arguing that with our friends from the states that once seceded. Is this a time when the church must step forward and speak about this situation? I believe it is. At some point, a line must be drawn across which we dare not step. 500 years ago, Luther argued we must call a thing for what it is. White supremacy, Nazi hate and violence cannot build a civil society, but will always create a social order that is self-destructive. We must call a thing for what it is. White supremacy is not a social order. It is disorder and death. It is said that liberal democracy and white supremacy are basically the same. It doesn't matter. You can have liberal democracy. You can have white supremacy. And one is not better than the other. Why can't we have our society that doesn't have to have any brown or black people in it? Why can't we have a society that is clean of all of these vermin? Why can't we have a society that says we want to live with who we want to live with and we don't want to live with these other people? Why can't we have that? Why is it liberal democracy or nothing at all? Why can't we have a society based on white supremacy? They are not the same. They are not equal. Why? Because one has proven itself to violate every moral norm that allows us to live together in peace and justice. It troubles me very greatly that there is what might be called a democracy of ideas. That sounds like it'd be good, right? Democracy of ideas, that all ideas are of equal truth, of equal legitimacy, and that the ideas of liberal democracy are no better than fascism and white supremacy. It's seen as a sign of sophistication to hold that all ideas are equal. Why do we say that you can't have the kind of society you want to have? Do you want to have a society that excludes all black people, all brown people, all gypsies, all Muslims, all Europeans of different types? Why can't we have it? You've got yours, we want ours. Why? Because calling a thing for what it is, not what it pretends to be, is the heart of the gospel. It is telling the truth. What follows are a series of points, 10 points, that I hope demonstrates why we must reject the false gospel of fascism, communism, and white supremacy. Not for political reasons, but for theological and spiritual reasons rooted in our biblical faith. One, as a Christian priest and theologian, my job is to preach and teach the truths of biblical faith. At this moment, this includes a very risky act of determining who or what is Christian and who or what is not. Let me read that again. At this moment, this includes a very risky act of determining who or what is Christian and who or what is not Christian. This is a dangerous move, especially for Episcopalians who are allergic, and properly so, to laying down the law for everyone else to follow. Who do we think we are, telling other people what is right and true and good about the Christian faith? Who are we to tell another that your church is not truly Christian? Episcopalians did this, or Anglicans did this, in the middle of the 17th century, and it almost destroyed England. It drove the Puritans out of England, and they ended up coming to New England. It's a dangerous move to say that we can take it upon ourselves to say that your church is not Christian. It's a dangerous move to say you are not a Christian. It's a dangerous move, but a necessary one. It is dangerous because it could lead to notions of religious superiority and even cause a split in the church, with each group claiming to be the one true faith and the other as heretics. It is indeed dangerous, but it is also necessary. Because there are times when the very meaning of the gospel is at stake, when there is confusion about what it means to be a Christian and what it means to be a church. When it is claimed that God made one group of people to be the servants of another, the gospel is denied. Four, there is a situation that Lutherans recognize, others do too, but it's Lutherans who developed and applied the idea. This situation is called status confessionis, or state of the confessions. This situation arises whenever there is a danger that the gospel will be distorted to such a degree that it is no longer possible to know what is true and what is false regarding Christian faith. So the Lutherans taught that there is this condition called status confessionis, the state of the confessions, that says that we have a situation of the state of the confessions when we have got to the place where we no longer know the difference between truth and falsehood. We no longer know what is the gospel of Jesus Christ and what is the gospel of Satan. And when we are that confused, that is called the confession of the church itself is at stake. It's not just a matter of we can believe this and we can believe that and everybody go home happy. This is saying, status confessionis, state of the confession, saying that we do not even know what the gospel is. And we must find out. 5. Demonstrating how dangerous the situation of status confessionis is, Lutherans have used it only 3 times in 500 years. The first time was during the Reformation when the churches were separating from Rome and there was confusion about what was true and what was false regarding the Christian faith. We can understand that. That makes a lot of sense. The church is splitting up and they're fighting with one another and it's unclear, do we go with Rome? Do we go with Calvin? Do we go with Luther? Do we go with Cranmer up in England? What is the truth? How are we to be led? So the first time was during the Reformation. The second time was during the reign of Nazi Germany. A group of pastors created what they called the Confessing Church. And they split off from the official church of Germany, which was run by the Nazi Party and the government. They risked their lives, these pastors, and their families. They risked their lives in doing so. Many ended up in concentration camps. Others, like Dietrich Bonhoeffer, were killed. As they did this, they made the audacious claim that they who do not belong to the confessing church, the church that they have created in Germany, as the alternative to the Nazi church, they made this audacious claim that they who do not belong to the confessing church do not belong to the church of Jesus Christ. In short, they claim that it is impossible to be a Nazi and be a Christian at the same time. The third time it was used was during apartheid in South Africa. The Lutheran World Federation excluded the white churches of South Africa and Namibia from fellowship with Lutherans around the world because the white apartheid church claimed that apartheid was not just acceptable, it was mandated by God. These churches taught that it was not just acceptable to have apartheid, but that it was mandated by God to maintain a society that they said was Christian. The Christians will maintain society as long as what? As long as the Africans are kept under control. As long as the Africans are not given any power in society at all. In each case, the theologians and churches declared that it was impossible for anyone to be a Nazi or a supporter of apartheid and claim to be a Christian. The claims of Nazi fascism and apartheid implied things about human beings that contravened the gospel. For example, that only the white Aryan race should be in power and dominate life. They claimed that it was right and good to create gas chambers and ovens, to murder over 6 million Jews, handicapped people, gypsies, Poles, Russians, and others. When you see that swastika walking down the street or standing up in a podium, if you wish to be a Christian, you must reject the claims that white racists preach, teach, and practice. It is not a matter of choice. Number 7. I believe now is the time of status confessionis. It's a state of the confessions. The confessions, that is the confession of faith in Jesus Christ, is at stake. If people teach that Jews, for example, or African Americans or refugees are inferior or are a threat to civilization because of their race, ethnicity, or religion, and make that claim using religious language to do so, the confession of the church is at stake. if there is a democracy of ideas that teaches that all ideas are basically the same, then we are in a state of the confessions. The gospel of Jesus Christ teaches us to distinguish between truth and falsehood and to oppose falsehood. There is no democracy of values or democracy of ideas. All ideas are not of equal worth. How do we know that one idea is better than another? How do we know that liberal democracy is better than Nazism or Confederate Restoration? We have thousands of years of experience that demonstrates with utter clarity that whenever there is injustice in society, that society eventually collapses and takes thousands of innocent people with it. Injustice inherently leads to instability. No society can survive if part of its citizens are treated unjustly. We don't have to go back thousands of years, though. We need just look at this past century. Communism and fascism almost destroyed the planet, killing between 60 and 80 million people. That is the proof that we need that justifies our claim that not all ideas are of equal value. 9. If we look at Isaiah 56, the handout, we'll see something quite remarkable. It starts with the phrase, "Maintain justice and do what is right, for my salvation is at hand." Now, what's being referred to? What's being referred to is that people are coming from around the whole Fertile Crescent and coming into Jerusalem, and that non-Jews are being invited and accepted to be on the hill, that is the hill of God, the mountain of God, that they belong there, says the text. Verse 3, "Let no foreigner who is bound to the Lord say, 'The Lord will surely exclude me from his people,' and let no eunuch complain, 'I am only a dry tree.'" What he's saying is that let no foreigner say that I am excluded. That is, the foreigner is included. No foreigner needs to be afraid. No foreigner needs to be told, "You don't belong here. Get away." Instead, the text tells us the foreigner is accepted. To the eunuchs, people that have been mutilated, and according to the law, according to Old Testament law, they are forbidden to be in the temple. They are forbidden to bring sin offerings or thank offerings. They are forbidden to be on God's holy hill. And yet, here is Isaiah quoting God, saying, "To the eunuchs who keep my Sabbath, who choose what pleases me and hold fast to my covenant, to them I will give within my temple and its walls a memorial." And get this, "A name better than sons and daughters. I will give them an everlasting name that will endure forever." What's he saying here? He's saying that even people that are should expect to be excluded are so radically included that they will have standing in the kingdom of God that is even greater than the ones who were born into it. "All of these I will bring to my holy mountain and give them joy in my house of prayer. For my house will be called a house of prayer for whom? For all nations." When we say that the confessions are at stake, this is what we're talking about. We're talking about God having such a heart that opens himself up to all of us, and that no one should feel they are excluded. And if no one should feel they are excluded, then what does that mean? That means that we cannot exclude anyone. That means that we, in our own actions, cannot exclude anyone. When we see people being oppressed, then we speak out. Why? Because the state of the confessions are at stake. Thanks be to God.